This was promising to be everything he said it would be, a marvelous adventure. And to think it was all taking place in my head. I was mesmerized. "We're on a spaceship," Paul said to me indifferently, as though he were discussing his lunch. I was not overly concerned or surprised. Just act natural, as though you attend such functions all the time. Follow my lead. You aren't the only Earthling aboard, so no one will pay you any undue attention. "You're talking as though this were real," I said, "rather than an imaginary situation. I know I must be in a trance. Maybe I should be anxious, but I'm not." "There's nothing to worry about, of course," he replied. "To maintain the atmosphere, though, it's best that we both act as if this were a real situation. It helps to sustain the mood and the illusion." I had no problem going along with that. So I put on my best ham manner and started to play the role that I thought was expected of me. I would immerse myself in the character and pretend with every emotive instinct I could summon to play my part naturally. I ran my hands and eyes over my body, which appeared to be clad in the same clothes I was wearing a few moments earlier in my yard. As I marveled aloud about the magic of the moment, Paul smiled benignly and subtly moved his right index finger to his lips to tell me to stay cool. "You are here," he said firmly. "Your body is not. This is what's known as an astral journey or visit. This is not a good time to explain. Just trust me." As I took another sip of my drink, which tasted somewhat like orange, perhaps a touch of a cinnamon, and a hint of something delicately zesty that I couldn't identify, Paul was looking across the room and then rose from his chair. He called out, but the language was not English. "There's someone I'd like you to meet," he said to me in English, "of course." At that, I also rose and turned in the direction of the individual he had hailed. The creature approaching us was anthropoid and bipedal, about 6 feet 6 inches in height, with a slender build. I would estimate its weight on Earth at perhaps 150 to 175 pounds. Its face was not unattractive, with very large, round eyes set afar apart that sparkled like yellow amber. The mouth was quite large, but not really disproportionate to the face, with full lips from which shone a set of brilliant white, straight teeth. The nose was thin and elongated, and quite sharply defined, similar to the shape that we humans would describe as aquiline. The individual had a high forehead and the skull was covered in soft, silken, golden hair that fell to shoulder length. But that description is a bit misleading, because the shoulders were separated from the head by a somewhat thin but muscular neck that was proportionately longer than a human's. The golden hair and the white teeth were set against an equally light skin color that would have drawn stares at any beach filled with tanned bodies. I didn't know the gender, but this exquisite individual seemed so dainty, so feminine, I suppose, that I just assumed I was being introduced to a female of her species. She didn't appear to be albino, but if she had lived on Earth, one could reasonably conclude that she spent little time in sunshine. Nevertheless, she was a delight to behold. The torso was quite long in proportion when compared with the human form, and the legs were short when judged by that same human standard. The most striking feature, though, was the length of the arms, which most certainly would reach to below the knees of the truncated legs if fully extended. However, the stranger kept its arms above the waist at all times while I was in its presence. The thought occurred to me that everything I was experiencing while being played out in my head was really created by Paul and planted in my brain like so much seed sown in a farmer's field. I simply lacked the required level of imagination to conjure up the strikingly elegant creature standing before me, nor any of the other elements of the astral journey, for that matter. The person was dressed in a one-piece outfit that covered the area from the collarbone to the ankles and wrists, and seemed to conform pretty closely to the shape of the body, which I had already guessed to be female. The material appeared to be some kind of cloth, but it had a sheen and the color was a dark violet or purple. Paul spoke to the individual in that same foreign tongue, and the stranger replied. "This is Grace," Paul said to me. "She is one of the few people on the ship whose name can be literally translated from her native language to English. Her name means beauty and charm, so Grace is the appropriate translation." To my surprise, Grace spoke fairly decent English and we exchanged pleasantries. The following exchange is the gist of our brief conversation. "Oh, a beam rider," Grace said, flashing an amused smile. "Did you enjoy it?" I looked dependently at Paul. He understood my look of incomprehension and proceeded to explain. "A so-called beam rider is someone who is moved from one place to another by teleportation, the movement of matter through space by transforming it into energy and then reconverting the energy back into matter again at the terminal point. Some people refer to it as being beamed from point A to point B, thus the term beam rider." "He wasn't beamed up," Paul explained to Grace. "We are actually on an astral visit. We'll just be staying for a few minutes and then we have to get back." "Well, I'm sorry you can't visit longer. It's always nice to meet new people," she said to me. "Some of my people, mostly youths, take beam rides just for recreation," she said. "They think it's fun. I think it's kind of immature, but it's a harmless practice. They grow out of it. Well, some of my people, and not just kids, jump off high towers and bridges attached to a giant rubber band. I think it's insane," I responded, keeping up the pretense that I was in a real situation rather than a fantasy. "But it was terrific fun and I went along with it enthusiastically. I'll take beam riding over bungee jumping anytime," I added. We chatted amicably for about 5 minutes, after which Grace said goodbye and returned to the group across the room. It consisted of several obviously different species. "Where's she from?" I asked, continuing the charade. Paul responded in the same mode, telling me that Grace comes from one of the galaxies in the group of galaxies known as the Virgo Supercluster, the same one to which the Milky Way and our nearest neighbor galaxy, Andromeda, belong. "I know almost zip about astronomy or the heavens, although both hold a fascination for me, and it is too late in life for me to begin a study of this subject, but if I understood him correctly, the supercluster contains about 3,000 galaxies and is about 100 million light years across. If so, that means that Grace, if she were real, would be a neighbor, although I never learned whether she would be a close neighbor or a more distant one. Grace would be the equivalent of a human young adult, perhaps 18 to 20 years old in human terms, although her chronological age in Earth years would be closer to 40, Paul said. I had to give him credit. He didn't get out of character for even a moment, never made the tiniest slip. He was inside my head, and yet he never once gave any indication of that, completely giving himself over to the role. She has been aboard for about 5 Earth years and probably will leave the ship and return home in another year or two. She is one of several hundred such exchange students aboard, representing almost as many different species, he said. So, what's in her future? Finish her schooling, begin a career, get married, have kids, buy a house in the suburbs? I asked whimsically. To my surprise, Paul gave me a straightforward answer to my frivolous remark. Pretty much so. However, her people don't have marriage. She'll likely take a mate and get a house in the suburbs, as you so quaintly put it. But it's unlikely that she will have children. What would you say if I told you that she's a homosexual? I stared at him dumbly. Then I blinked. I remember trying to maintain a detached look, as if to say you can't shock me. But I'm sure all kinds of emotions were doing a lively dance across my face. I casually glanced over my shoulder toward Grace, shifted the weight on my feet, temporizing as I groped for the words that would constitute an appropriate response. It was useless. Hot darn, this was so much fun. I was having a magnificent time. If I was nonplusses, something positive did emerge from the moment, however. His sense of humor was showing. Paul locked eyes with me and I could see his face doing a frolicsome dance, and he was enjoying it immensely. You know, if you had a Star Trek phaser, you could save a lot of words by zapping me with it, I said. It wouldn't be any more stunning than these periodic zingers you keep hitting me with. The mock gaze of bafflement didn't fool me. He was still playing the game. Oh, he said after a moment's silence, the space fantasy on your television and movie screens. How have I stunned you? The gay thing. I fairly blurted in embellished exasperation. He knew he had jolted me, but he feigned innocence as though he couldn't imagine what might bring on such a reaction. I admit that he had me off balance. I wondered if he was smiling inwardly. Sometimes I couldn't tell when he was serious or merely tweaking my nose playfully. Perhaps it was a combination of both. "Of course," he said, "many humans still haven't come to grips with that aspect of their physiological diversity. Well, no matter. Those homophobic demons will someday be exorcised. It's just a matter of time and education. Homosexuality is rare in the universe simply because of the scarcity of wide-ranging diversity among most species," Paul said. He added, to my amazement, that it is more common among humans than any other species. Paul went on to explain that there are a number of species that, while nowhere near as disparate as the human race, are not totally homogeneous, and it is in these cultures that homosexuality is present in limited forms. It is simply accepted as a normal part of the physiological tapestry of the species. "Don't tell me you're a homophobe," Paul said. Did his tone indicate suspicion? No. He was still teasing. "I'd be very surprised if I was mistaken about you to that degree." "Not at all," I replied. "I believe in live and let live. However, the Christian Bible does say it's an abomination," I added. Again the look across the shoulder and down the nose. Just what in blazes was that look supposed to mean, anyway? He had a habit of aiming it at me at various times, and I thought I had figured it out. But I wasn't sure now. It seemed to carry a slightly different meaning every time he laid it on me. Skepticism. Mild reproof. "No, now I had it," it said. "And just whom do you think you're kidding with your nonsense?" "And how would you know?" he asked. "Well, I've heard rumors of a sort," I replied. "Anyway, I was joking." Of course, he was right. I had never read the Bible and he knew it. I actually have two or three of them somewhere around the house, but have never been able to get beyond the first three or four pages. It's not exactly a page-turner, to my mind. Besides, the opening doesn't make any sense to me. I figured that if I was lost so quickly into it, I sure wasn't going to be able to follow the plot, so I gave up. "Do you know that homosexuality has been a part of the human makeup from the time your species first appeared? I'm talking about a very long time," he said. "Another blast from the phaser." "No, I didn't know that. I've never given it much thought." He was right about this being a learning experience. I didn't know if what he was telling me was actual fact or if it was fiction for the sake of the production The Astral Journey, but it was interesting, nevertheless. "Do you know where you would be today if all of the contributions that homosexuals have made to human society and culture over the ages were suddenly wiped out?" he asked. "Bangladesh." Again I got the look. "I'm sorry," I said. "Sometimes I don't know when to keep no, no." "I'm not scolding," he said softly, laying a hand gently upon my shoulder. "What do I know about such things?" I asked. "I'm not an expert on anything. I'm just a retired newspaperman. Love and sex are not intertwined among some species as they are in human romantic relationships," Paul went on. "I had heard similar theories about love, sex, and marriage several years earlier under quite unusual circumstances." The conversation was almost a rehash of these previous discussions on the subject. Paul was playing devil's advocate, although I didn't know it at the time, when he went on to suggest that there might be a weakness in the human marriage arrangement. "And what might that be?" I asked, perhaps a bit defensively. "It's just a theory, an observation," he replied. "I'll tell you, but I don't want you to take offense. It's not a criticism of your culture." We were interrupted in our dialogue several times when various individuals, not human as far as I could tell, approached Paul and exchanged words with him. "Actually, that's just a wild guess." In reality, they exchanged sounds with him, which I guessed to be words. However, even that was not the case for one odd individual, rather short, no more than 4 feet tall, under 100 pounds, bipedal, delicate features, and wearing a wraparound sarong-like garment that covered him or her from neck to ankles, this one stood face to face with Paul as though in conversation, and yet I heard not a sound. Their visit lasted about 2 minutes. My mind was racing in high gear by now. As if this so-called re-journey weren't uncanny enough, one had to wonder if it wasn't pushing the limits of plausibility to sincerely believe that Paul was creating this whole scenario in my mind. The details alone would leave one breathless. Was it really a fantasy, or was it possible that in reality either Earth-born person who is me was actually in this place on an astral visit, even as my physical body reposed on the deck chair back home? There's no doubt the situation was surreal. The scene was not exactly dreamlike, but it was still lacking just a little bit of that solid, down-to-earth quality of the fully awake state. There may have been slight elements of a fugue or dissociation. If so, it could only be described as a hint of such. Perhaps that's the normal feeling when one is in a trance. I just don't know. I was pretty sure that my physical body wasn't present, but I couldn't swear to that either. It was downright confusing. Paul returned to my side. "You looked like you were speaking," I said. "Yes. I didn't hear a word." "No, you wouldn't have. It was a private conversation." "Without words?" I asked suspiciously. He merely smiled, or was it a Cheshire Cat grin? "You and I were talking about your marriage customs," he said. "Right." He hoped I wouldn't take offense. I assured him that I leaned toward giving all the rational ideas and opinions a fair hearing, whether or not I agree. I gave up any thought of asking him how he had communicated with the previous individual, why he hadn't introduced me, or, heaven forbid, what they were talking about. Then he went off on a long dissertation about the human condition from a universal perspective, rattling off facts and figures and hopscotching from subject to subject, touching on sociology, physiology, religion, and psychology. "People on Earth," he said, "classify love into two major groups, sexual and non-sexual. These two categories are broken down into two distinct subgroups, instinctive and purposeful. Because most humans do not hold in their hearts a universal love for all other people, although there are several million idealists who are exceptions, the vast majority selectively personalize love. They choose the people they love either purposefully or instinctively. Most love of family members such as parents, children, grandchildren, grandparents, and siblings is generally instinctive. These relationships are considered strictly non-sexual." "The lines begin to blur," Paul said, "when it comes to the love of more distant relatives such as aunts and uncles, nieces and nephews, and cousins. All of these can be either instinctive or purposeful. These relationships are considered non-sexual, and it is generally taboo and often illegal in much of the world for such blood relatives to engage in sexual intimacy. Love of non-family members, such as best friends, favorite movie stars, heroes of all types, or religious leaders, for example, is categorized as purposeful," Paul observed. "That is, the person consciously chooses to love the designated one. It could be argued, though, that the love of a true national icon such as General Dwight Eisenhower, who led a grateful nation to wartime victory, could be instinctive." "Here again," Paul told me, "the lines blur, and the love could be of either a sexual or non-sexual variety. In the case of Eisenhower, it was probably mostly non-sexual. But what of the adoring fans of Elvis Presley? How much of the affection of his millions of admirers, particularly among females, was free of a sexual element?" "I'm trying to follow you," I told Paul, "but I'm not sure where you are going. I'm still looking for the so-called weakness that you see in our marriage customs. Do you want it in a nutshell?" he asked. "Please." "Humans believe that the tapestry of marriage is woven from the fibers of love. There are those who contend that the whole thing would unravel and fall to the floor in a jumbled heap if somehow nature suddenly drained your reservoirs of certain essential chemicals," he said. I needed time to digest that. I tried to think of some dilatory maneuverings, but nothing came to mind. I merely stared at Paul. I thought I'd try posturing, but he'd see right through that. "Oh, well, if honesty is the best policy, I might as well just get on with it." "And what conclusions am I supposed to draw from that?" I asked. I'm not even sure that I would agree with it, even if I really knew what it meant. That question and statement opened up another floodgate. According to the chemical deprivation theory, he went on, millions of impending marriages would be called off and even millions of established marriages would crumble. That's because the engine driving those relationships is lust-based rather than love-based, according to some observers. He didn't mention whether these observers were of the human or non-human type. Naturally, many marriages, the ones that are truly love-based, would remain intact. Loss of libido would certainly wound those particular relationships, but they could survive, the theory goes. Let me set a scenario for you, and then you tell me if you don't agree that the reasoning processes are bizarre, at the least, if not perverse. I'm listening, I said. A man professes his undying romantic love for a woman, but she spurns his attention. She has no sexual interest in him. He then decides that if can't have her, nobody can, and he kills her. Can that truly be someone's idea of love? He asked. Millions of women are brutalized daily throughout the world by men who purportedly love them, who are supposed to be their protectors, not their victimizers, Paul continued. Love means caring so deeply about another individual that a person would go to almost any lengths, make whatever sacrifices he or she is capable of making in good conscience, to ensure the happiness, the well-being, the comfort of the loved one. A hypothetical character that I just described, upon being rejected by the object of his affections, should take the woman's hands in his, look lovingly into her eyes, and tell her that he understands and that he wishes her every happiness in life. And then he should walk away in dignity, hoping with all his heart that life would be a good to her, Paul said. That is what love is, apostrophe, he explained. To deliberately inflict harm, pain, or death upon another in the name of love or God, for that matter, is an obscenity of incomprehensible proportions. And, of course, it really isn't love. It's lust, obsession, ego, something twisted out of all normal appearance. He then touched on the high divorce rate among humans, the jealous rages of domestic violence, the devastating effects on children of broken families, and the hateful battles of divorcing couples over community property and custody of children. I was starting to feel like a mugging victim, and I momentarily wondered if was purposely putting me through an arduous harangue for some cruel reason that I could not fathom. I immediately dismissed the thought because the notion ran counter to everything I knew about Paul as extremely intelligent, highly compassionate, warm-hearted, polite, and caring, not to mention that an evidence of unkind intentions on his part would directly contradict what he was in the act of teaching. Infliction of cruelty was not in Paul's nature. And I guess I couldn't even call it a tirade, because there really was no emotion displayed. He had merely held a mirror up to me as a representative of my species, and I saw some very ugly truths that I would have preferred not to see. Then, are you condemning the human institution of marriage? I asked. Not at all, Paul replied. Would you ask your mechanic if he was condemning your automobile just because he found a malfunctioning part? Of course not. Do you know which of your marriages are the most successful ones, statistically? He asked, as though not even hearing my question. I'll tell you, marriages in later life when the flames of passion do not burn with the same intensity as they did in youth. Lust becomes less of a driving force, and the more mature and wiser couple who fall in love do so because they find that they truly like and care about each other as spiritual soulmates and want to travel through their remaining days together. He was pursuing his point with great enthusiasm. There seemed to be an attitude of, what? Dot. Certainly not malice or arrogance. Not self-righteousness or smugness. Paul was not trying to disillusion me or force me to admit that his position was right and mine was wrong. Despite what a casual observer might think, the real issue here was not the human marriage custom. That subject was merely the vehicle he was using to achieve his goal. And what was that goal? The very one that every good teacher shoots for. He was trying to trigger some thinking, to motivate me to reflect, to question. Lovingly and tenderly, he was trying to teach me to challenge accepted concepts so that I could not embrace them simply because they represented popular thought. He wanted me to accept or reject them based upon my own quest for the truth. A teacher can experience no greater reward than inspiring a student to embark upon a lifelong pursuit of learning in search of truth. Somehow, Paul knew that he had reached me, and he was reveling in the joy of that accomplishment. So there it was. We really weren't talking about sex, love, marriage, and romance. Those were the topics, but they weren't the real subject. He could just as easily have talked about flower arrangement and taxidermy and still gotten his message across. Paul was merely three highlighters, using those themes as tools to get to the heart of the real issue, the value of independent, reflective thinking. He was a sage, a teacher, and I was the student who had just been put through a grueling lesson. I could almost feel the wheels of the cerebral mechanism begin to whir as my brain shifted toward a more analytical mode from the one of imagination that had been occupying my time so entertainingly. At the same time, probably because my focus had shifted, I felt the fantasy trance, delusion, hypnotic spell, whatever one wants to call it, beginning to slip away. And then, in a nanosecond, I was back on my patio chair. Paul was standing over me, smiling. "What happened?" I asked, jarred by the suddenness of the transition. "You broke the spell. It's okay, though. I'm actually impressed because you held on to the suspended state of consciousness much longer than I would have expected. That's unusual for a first experience." Modesty having never been one of my strong suits, I puffed up a bit upon hearing that news. "It wasn't very difficult. Acting isn't that hard. It was quite a trip, though," I said. "I can see why some people have a fascination with hallucinogenic and psychedelic drugs. Wow. One thing, though, apostrophe yes? That dot. Go one, Grace. Yes. Just out of curiosity, even though she isn't real, why did you make her gay? Just food for thought." And then he left in his customary manner. I sat alone for a few minutes longer, reliving the experience, cogitating. Was Paul holding something back for some reason? Was it really a journey of the mind, strictly an imaginary excursion? Or was it possible that I had indeed, sans body, traveled to a bona fide place? I wonder. Precocious child. I couldn't shake the memory, couldn't get it out of my head. The journey Paul and I had just taken was, to put it in the vernacular of the street, a mind-blowing event. Such simple adjectives as fantastic, astounding, or stunning simply don't do the proper job of conveying the magnificence and magnitude of it all. It preoccupied me to the point where I had difficulty falling asleep at night. After hours of tossing and turning, I would have to make a conscious effort to clear my mind of all thoughts so that sleep could set in. The typical period required for most people to fall into deep sleep is approximately 7 minutes. Sometimes I would get probably as far as 5 or 6 minutes of keeping my mind clear of all thought, only to fall back into thinking about the experience again. And then I had to start all over again, trying to achieve the 7 minutes of total mental blankness. When I met Paul again a few days later, it was my intention to immediately bring the subject around to the astral voyage. I had a million questions that had to be asked or I would explode, I thought. We met, of all places, at a local commuter train station to take a round trip to Los Angeles. It is about a 35 or 40 minute ride one way, with the line terminating at the historic Union Station downtown. The station also serves as a major hub for the Metro Rail subway system that is methodically and gradually reaching out tentacles along some of the busier commuter destinations throughout the greater metropolitan area. I arrived at the local station about 15 minutes early, bought my ticket at the vending machine, and looked about in vain for some sign of Paul. I began to grow a bit anxious as the minutes ticked down to departure time and still caught no sight of him. The rails resonated a barely detectable hum that signaled an approaching train, which moments later lumbered into view in the distance, just about the same time that Paul sauntered up onto the platform in fully embodied form. At least that's the way he appeared to me. It was late May or early June of 2002, as I recall, a month more or less before the scheduled family reunion. I was dressed warmly enough to remain comfortable in the morning chill, but still lightly enough that I wouldn't be too uncomfortable if the day turned warm. Paul was dressed in, of all things, a brown suit with tie and was carrying a briefcase, blending in quite well with the eclectic mix of commuters. We made eye contact just about the same moment that someone called out my name as I was about to enter the train to grab a couple of seats for Paul and me. I turned in the direction of the voice,